Welcome to A State of Readiness, a podcast set as a fireside chat with business leaders to discuss what it takes for a company to be in a state of readiness and become a high-performance organization with your host, Joseph Paris. Hello, and welcome to another episode of State of Readiness, a podcast set as a fireside chat between me, your host, Joseph Paris, and a select leader. Today, that select leader is Manuel Manny Ugarte. Manny has been serving the United States in its operations around the world as a U.S. Army officer and executive for over 25 years. His leadership and military experiences have focused on strategic planning, process improvement, operations, and complex problem solving. As an executive leader, he embraces operational excellence methods, directing high-performance teams on problem-solving techniques informed by business intelligence. Throughout his career, Manny has held many positions, including stints as Director of Analytics at the Office of the Secretary of Defense, Chief Operating Officer at U.S. Special Operations Command, and Senior Operations Research Analyst at the Army Futures Command. Currently, Manny is Director and Strategic Accounts Manager to oversee the science and technology strategic planning program, budget, and execution of experimental and state-of-the-art capabilities of the U.S. Army's Combat Capabilities Development Command, the subordinate organization of the nascent Army Futures Command. He earned his bachelor's degree in mechanical engineering from Norwich University and master's degree in business administration and operations research and engineering management from Penn State University. He is a certified Lean Six Sigma Black Belt practitioner and Master Black Belt candidate from the U.S. Army. Manny recently completed an executive program certification in management and leadership from Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He's married, his wife, Mary, and two children, Manuel and Carlos. His hobbies include CrossFit, running, yoga, and racquetball. Welcome, Manny.
Thanks for having me, Pete. I appreciate it. I'm humbled by your introduction there.
you've done quite a bit. And I'll tell you what, anybody that visits your LinkedIn profile will realize that I left about 75 or 80% of it off.
You know? Well, I mean, I probably get people lost. Hey, these guys is all over the map. We said, but again, it's about enjoying what you do. And you know, once I find something that interests me or that people trust me to do, I'm all in. So, you know, it's been a thrill.
Well, I mean, you know, the roles and positions you have held are, well, you know, just the titles themselves are very interesting. But it sounds like it's always been about data analytics, research, analyzing the information that that's being collected. But on top of that, you have this operations side. So it seems like, it's not military intelligence as much as, you know, which is right, an oxymoron, they say. But, it's about how do you collect that information, convert it to the betterment of the operations of the U.S. military and the Army in particular.
Correct. And it's fascinating because, you know, in comparing what I've been involved with to other career paths, they tend to be more linear. Basically, these are the things you got to do to continue to progress through your career path and the things you're expected to do. Most importantly, working with people, you know, leading people and how you get processes in place to take care of people, to accomplish the missions you set out to do. But in operations research, we call it operations research and systems analysis, we're basically like internal consultants to the Army. So we're not pigeonholed in one specific area. We're basically giving a set of tools or being exposed to or trained in a set of tools to be data-driven and enable decision-making. So basically, wherever you go, is, hey, what's the state of play? What are the factors that are informing or not decisions, and then you start finding out frameworks that can help those decision leaders do their job. So it's kind of, I don't want to call ourselves unicorns, but I mean, there are not many of us, I guess. But again, sometimes the way we articulate the things we do has to be in a way that people can resonate with folks. You know, if you come in and say, I'm an operations research and systems analysis, and I do, you know, math informed decision making, I mean, people start rolling their eyes and all of a sudden they don't know what to do with you. But when you say, I'm here to help, I'm here to add value to what you do, and I'm going to look at ways to inform and perhaps help your decision-making, I'm basically a military analyst. I think I saw a YouTube video not long ago. I think Ashton Kutcher, that he goes and beats with his dad, and his dad is an analytics guy, and he's talking about, hey, dad, what do you do for a living? It's like a day with dad. And he goes about explaining, you know, standard deviation and how he uses analytics and all that. And at the end, you know, Ashton Kutcher, you know, his hair is all over the place, and he doesn't understand what his dad is telling him. At the end, he's telling his dad, "Dad, I'm just going to say you're the farmer." basically, that's how it goes with us. It's like, you know, we need to be able to learn the environment we work in, learn the culture, and be able to understand then what are those key levers that enable the organization to move forward and accomplish what they set out to do. Mm-hmm. And you do that across. So being in the U.S. Army or being outside in the business that you've been in, JP, it's basically very similar. And yes, we're in uniform, and you know the type of activities that we engage, you know, may sound like different, but they're not. And hopefully I'm able to talk a little bit about that throughout our meeting here, our fireside meeting in August.
Yeah, right. It's stinking hot where I am here in Germany. So, and of course, Germans don't believe in air conditioning, so it's kind of rough here right now. But, you know, I'm looking at, did you go through an ROTC program?
I did. Okay. In fact, the school that I went to, Norwich University, that's where ROTC was founded. You know, that was.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, yes. And this is phenomenal because, you know, and let me just backtrack a little bit. You know, before I chose Norwich, a lot of people ask me, I'm from Puerto Rico. I was born and raised there. My family are Cuban exiles. I'm first generation Cuban American. So, you know, I always been eager to, hey, for some reason, my dad instilled in me kind of, hey, you should serve. You know, we lost something that we'll never get back to, but we should all do our part. We should all serve. And he was a mechanical engineer. He went to school on a federal grant given to Cuban exiles to study in Puerto Rico, University of Mayagüez. And so he went and did what he had to do and earn his living, earn his salt. And that's the grit and the values that he instilled in me. But he always mentioned that you should consider serving, do your part, you know, and then come back and then we'll see where we go from there. So I was kind of debating, I always been kind of, for some reason, never been any military guy in my family, except my great grandfather in Spanish Navy a long time ago. But for some reason I was always drawn to the Army. And, but I wanted to also be like my dad, you know. It was, I love what he did, going to the field, working HVAC systems and going construction sites. And he said, what do I got to do this? This is pretty cool. He said, well, I mean, you got to go to school, get yourself, hit the books, and then, and then we'll see. So I, through happenstance, found Norwich University, great engineering program, been around since 1819. In fact, the founder, Captain Alden Partridge, was the superintendent of West Point, but he had a vision. At the time, he thought, we need citizen soldiers. We need people that can understand how to build bridges, roads, infrastructure, so we can grow our nation, but also be able to have the skill set to defend it. So at the time, that was not the philosophy. So he went off and built this university that taught folks the military science and also the civil engineering science, so we can build our infrastructure. So ROTC was born, Reserve Officer Training Corps, you know, and very good reputation. And, you know, I thought, you know, I'm in Puerto Rico. I'm looking for a change. So how do I go to Vermont? So let me just embrace the change and let's be comfortable being uncomfortable, I guess, you know, that cliche. And I went for it. I never went back. So I did my Army ROTC lane. I did my engineering coursework. And I thought, you know, as you can tell, I have this thick Japanese accent, you know, Cuban accent. So I figure, hey, I speak the language I like. I'm interested in Latin America. So I figure I surf in that area and bring my engineering skill set and build bridges and build infrastructure and earn my salt all over the region and then come back and work with my dad. So
But your degree wasn't in civil engineering.
No, mechanical engineering.
Right.
Yeah, okay. So opening doors. So I figure civil engineer sounds good, but mechanical engineer, besides, I can probably reach out to my dad and give me, hey, tell me what's the story here. But out of all the engineering disciplines, seems to be very broad. And to be honest, like most people, you don't really know what, I mean, I kind of knew, but you're not certain. So I like, let me my options open. So anyways, long story short, I went for it, got my scar tissue for it, and joined the Army. I got assigned to Panama, and then, you know, got to be all over the region. So it kind of worked out. And I think I got sidetracked here on this story, but just...
Oh, no, that's a great story, because obviously somewhere along the way, you decided that, you know, 4 years wasn't enough, right? I mean,
correct.
You know, whatever your first sign up was, it wasn't exactly enough. And you kept on signing up and re-upping and re-upping.
Correct. So that's exactly right. That was not my intent. But let me tell you, out of a sudden you start doing things and you're like, oh man, this is so great. And then you go from one cool thing to the next cool thing. And like I said at the beginning, you know, when I'm in, you know, into something, I'm all in. So I can't help myself but get enthusiastic about it and say, one thing that I really fell in love, before I go there, one thing that I really enjoyed doing was working with other countries, other cultures. I enjoyed the diversity of thought and camaraderie that comes into when you work with other people into a common goal. And I was just fascinated by it. And I said, man, this is, I mean, especially if you have that cultural linkages, I guess. So I was able to communicate in many different levels, not just in the military side, but also, hey, we're doing some peacekeeping operations here. We're helping folks get better at what they do, enable others to do their work better. And I just find a lot of joy in doing that. And then, I mean, I was so in love with that actually I found my love there, my wife, Maria. So Maria was, I met her, I was like about a year into my 3-year assignment.
This is in Panama, right?
In Panama, yeah, in Panama. Okay. So, I met her and then things were going great. I'm like, man, I love this country. I want to stay. What do I have to do? And then we were on a countdown. We were getting ready to leave the country, like closing down the bases and all that. And came across some folks, you know, I'm talking to anybody. And these folks, people were getting laid off. And you know, these guys that were servicing these vending machines, you know, I said, what are you guys doing with all these vending machines? Well, we have them all stored in this warehouse. And, you know, we're trying to see if we kind of bring them back to the States. We're trying to see if somebody can buy them. And so I'm like, oh, so that's a business idea. So there you go. That's my answer. I'm going to start a business. I'm going to stay in Panama. I'm going to live the dream. I'm going to continue on. And so, you know, I don't want to get too long-winded on that story. But yeah, I started buying vending machines. I started vending machine business in Panama, moonlighting as I was doing my work on the side, you know. So I started hiring the folks that were getting laid off. I mean, these guys were basically working there for 20 years, and now they have a skill set that was not very useful in the outside market because there were no – I mean, I think there were some bottling companies there, but not the vending business at the time. So I'm like, okay, great. I can get these machines for free. I mean, not free, very, very cheap.
Yeah.
You know, I got some of the technicians to service it. Start getting, I got someone that was interested in partnering with me. And my wife was a lawyer there. So she helped out with the structure of the business. Things were all in, you know, like, oh my God, I'm staying. This is awesome. And then you start learning, you know, then you go to the school of hard knocks.
Yeah,
you know, as you all know, you know, business is it sounds great. It's enthusiasm is awesome, but once you start dealing with people, and you gotta start making some business to business decisions, you gotta work with suppliers, you gotta start doing some pricing discussions, and I mean everything was going actually well, but then you start generating a lot of volume. So some bottling companies were like, hey, you're generating a lot of volume. We gotta talk about price. About the cost of this, and then, you know, you start working with people, and then some people, then you start finding out you have some competition, and you know, you know, with the machine, all you have to do is to unplug it, and there you go, no competition. I think the Russians say, if you got a problem, if you have a people problem, no people, no problem. Well, here, if you have a vending machine competition, no vending machine, no problem. So So I start dealing with the unplugging conundrum. But you know, the most important thing that I learned was on the cultural front, which was I was the outsider, the big, you say they call it gringo, you know, you're the gringo outsider coming in with big money, you know, and now you're going to take our jobs and you're going to take our bread, you know, and you know, my biggest competition was the old lady that working whatever building that brought the empanadas and the Coke and she had a cooler and everybody liked, you know, I could not beat her. She's the one that everybody empathized with. And I was the outsider taking away her livelihood. And how can you compete there, man? Anyways.
Now hold it. You were doing all of this while you were in the Army.
Yes, I was doing that on the weekends, at night. You know, of course, I had to check out, you know. You know, because I wanted to stay, you know. I mean, there was no other, I could not make a deal so I could stay longer because I was the last one out with the keys in my hand, crying, not letting people, don't take that key away. So I was literally doing whatever I could to stay in the in country. Oh, my God, I'm laughing here. But, you know, this is...
That's one of the craziest stories I ever heard ever. I got to tell you, that's one of the craziest stories. You know, an officer getting married in Panama, seeing a bunch of these excess vending machines, deciding, hey, I can start a business and moonlighting on the side. That's just crazy. That's a crazy story.
Yeah, but, you know, I wanted to make it work. You know, the thing is, you know, like every business, you get infatuated with that. So all you think about is like, how do I beat this old lady that she's kicking my butt? I mean, I'm using that as the fictional character, but it was replicated in every place I went to. There was always one lady with the empanadas, with a Coke machine, you know, I mean, with a Coke bottle, and she was beating me down. I was like, I came here with the technology, you know, the future is now. I'm here to make your life better. You know, but you know what? This was 20 years ago. And look now, look at what we do. We're trying to introduce new technologies. Just trying to do this app for that. We're trying to make people process better with new things and gadgets and all that. But it comes down to people. It comes down to that human terrain, to understanding what are the things that really move people around. And that's the business we're in. Got to understand the people, you know, but it's on, you know, again, I'm using that as a story to tell, you know, I thought I had all my ducks in the row. I was going to take the market. In fact, it was pretty good. I ended up having like 34 machines all over the place. I got married. I went, at the time, of course, I had to get income. So I was not generating enough. So I like, I don't think I can, I can make a living off that. My wife is starting her, you know, legal career, you know, already blazing through into a very good firm, you know. And so, again, those are the things that all those irons in the fire demonstrating I want to stay here. So I had to make a business proposition. Well, no, not business proposition. I think it's the best deal I ever made was to I proposed to her and told, hey, sweetie, you know, I want to come back, but I got to probably stay for another tour. You know, how about we get married? And she accepted. I was like, oh my God, she said yes to this. But
between your military career, your engagement as an entrepreneur, you know, how did you find time to, you know, court your wife?
I had to think very hard about that. And the solution was, well, let's make her part of the business.
The story gets better all the time.
So it's like, I need a lawyer. I need somebody to help me, you know, make sure that I'm straight here. But I swear marry the lawyer. You know, it's a good business.
that's great. Good thing you didn't get into shipping. You would have had to marry a ship's captain.
You know, sometimes you got to do what you got to do, I guess. But then sometimes love makes everything work. Actually, she's the brains and the bro. I mean, she's the one that kept me grounded because, I mean, if it's not, I'll be off the flying wheel. I'll be all over the place. And she's like, hey, let's put our heads in here. Let's make this thing very pragmatic. And because, I mean, business is great. Enthusiasm is great. but that doesn't really, you know, make sometimes a smart decision. So enthusiasm is awesome. It's definitely got to have that part of your special sauce into it, but you got to have the brains and the clarity of mind to make sure that, you know, wise decisions are made, and especially having a smart lawyer next to you helps a lot. So that's how we went. I mean, she structured it. She actually helped out with the processes to get the thing going, and because it's a cash business.
Sure, so, right.
You know how you keep things tight in a cash business, and sometimes you just gotta, you know, roll with it and see how things go. We were trying to get some, you know, and that was the other lesson I did. I wanted to get my spreadsheets out, start counting cents here and there. And sometimes there's so much you can't control, but you have to sometimes minimize the variance, but try to live within the variance, you know. But it worked out. Sometimes you have to work on, hey, what are the things that move people? Again, what are the common salaries? You know, what are the other incentives you want to bring in to keep those employees that had a unique skill set that were losing a job in a way that also has some kind of a motivation and attractiveness to be part of this venture? Because, you know, those are things you got to keep in play. So, you know, again, learn that one, learn the old lady competition piece, and also learn and say, sometimes cheaper doesn't mean it's good. You know, so if you're getting machines that already have some mileage into it, you're going to have to get some maintenance into it. So I learned that lesson as well. You know, I'm learning lessons left and right. I'm like, my God, you know, and then I'm looking at the clock because the clock is ticking and I want to get the thing up and running. And I had my partner that wanted to be part of this and was enthusiastic as well. But, you know, sometimes we choke on it, and he also had all the interest because I mean, a lot of opportunities were happening in the country as we were going into the new millennial. So he also had other business ventures that were taking his time and energy. And sometimes things can get really, really murky when I have to disengage and move on to my next assignment, hoping to come back. But, you know, and he said, hey, I'm going to be now the outside partner. I'll be in the States, and I can work, you know, if you need to get parts and all that, but I need to be kind of keeping the pulse on things. My wife, in a way, volunteered to stay a little bit, and that's another story, you know, and she's like, you know, so let me see this. You're in the States, I'm here, you know, running all this, and all of a sudden she's the one holding it back, making sure things were, again, you're starting a new business. You can't, not the time to move on. So anyways, after a little bit of time, then they say it's best to go ahead and sell it. We sold it back to the employees, actually, because they're the ones that were vested into it, and their livelihood was into that. They knew the business inside out. They were Panamanians. They had their rapport. They were not the outsider trying to take on jobs and their livelihoods. And it worked out.
They might be able to compete with the old lady.
Now I'm gonna beat you, lady. I'm gonna go native in the business, you know. but it worked out. So actually, that brought a lot of joy. It gave a few folks a livelihood, and they say, guys, you know, take that on. I gotta move on, and then actually bring my wife with me to wonderful Fort Hood, Central Texas. Oh my God, that I still hearing about it. You know, like Panama City, you know, to Killeen, Texas. That was the tumbleweed passing by. And my wife said, oh, these deals are just getting better and better, man. But, you know, my winning personality keeps playing, I guess. You know, you can't do that for so long because I'm still paying for it. We've been married 20 years, actually. We just crossed our 20-year mark a couple of weeks ago.
Congrats.
Yeah, thank you. But let me tell you, I own it to her. But that was my experience. So you're looking at me, a military officer, 25 years in. But yeah, I got my stories, man. I feel you. You know, I understand how things go, because on my tiny little international startup, I learned so much. And then I went on to get, he said, I need to learn this stuff. So I went to not the real school. I went to school on it. I got an MBA there while I was working in Fort Hood. I was doing that at night. And it's because, again, my intent initially was like, okay, I'm going to learn. I love the Army. I love working with people here, but I want to move on to other things. But, you know, shortly after that, finished my MBA, and a few weeks later, 9/11 happened. and I was already tagged to be a commander of an outfit, and that was not the time to move on. So I said, okay, let's buckle up, Buttercup. Let's do this. And my wife was with me at the time. So again, that was another deal. So, okay, so here I am in Fort Hood, and we know things are getting hairy here. And she was actually, she was also getting her master's in law at the time. So she just stuck through, and I had to go, and she just continued on. And I owe her a lot for that. Came back and then got another assignment close to in Houston. And again, it's okay. Now I'm really getting out. I got my experience here. I done great. I want to move on to other things. But then it's, hey, are we going to start a family? Or what's the deal here? You know, how are we going to go about it? Well, you know, I got to pay the bills. And it's like, so I'm talking to the Army, and the Army tells me, yeah, we got a deal for you. We'll make you this operations research systems analysis. Yeah, it sounds fancy, like you saw on my titles there. Again, sounds great. He said, well, what does it mean? Do I need to break stuff? And he said, yeah, you get to break stuff and test stuff, but we got an assignment for you in Monterey, California, if you choose to select that. So I'm like, okay.
Houston, Monterey. Fort Hood, you know.
So you say Monterey, but I didn't know Monterey. I knew we had the National Training Center in Fort Irwin, California, which is a desert, and it's a training site. And I'm like, man, all I know is this Irwin desert. This is not gonna be good. Monterey, I mean, and then again, this is just how oblivious I was to all these options. And so we checked that out, and then I see golf courses and all that. So I mistyped the thing. This is probably not the Monterey I'm looking for. So, yeah, sure enough, it's, hey, it sounds like a winner there. My wife says, hey, we're going. So, yeah, sure enough, we had a baby in Houston, and we continue to start our family in Monterey. And then from there, you'll stay there for a few years. Got to go to grad school again on the Army offered me to go there. Say, of course, 2 more years in Monterey. How can I say no to that? But, you know, for every year you go to grad school, you own the Army 3 years. So I was already getting over my 10-year mark. It's, hey, let's go all in, and let's do this. Let's go for the 20. And, you know, it was actually pretty good. Doing my time in Monterey, got to meet very interesting folks, got to do some pretty cool testing and working with robots and autonomy and all these things as it was going. And I stay in touch with a lot of folks to this day. You know, and then it's about the relationships you build along the way. You know, being with people, hey, listening to, understanding the culture, what are the things that move that research community, how we can bring that into our community as well, so it become a capability. So yeah, from there, then I say I got the bug. I want to continue doing this technology business, and then got sent here to Aberdeen Proving Ground in Maryland. And got to work with some folks here in the testing community. And then from here, I got to go overseas for a year to deal with this ISIS problem, you know. And that was pretty good to see how we can go from devising a strategy to operationalize it all the way down to the tactical level, see the results, and all that within a year. That was a fascinating organization I worked with. You know, the people there was just like amazing, sharp.
But were you based in Germany during that time?
No. During that time, we got sent initially to Qatar, and then Kuwait, and then we have different bases in Iraq, and we got some folks at the time working in the border with Syria and all that. Because again, it was this cancer that was all over the region that we were trying to make sure we took care of it. And again, you know, got exposed to that type of organization. But it was pretty neat to see how everybody with a common focus, clarity of mission, clarity of hey, this is the direction we're going. All the waste went to the side. We were just as lean as we could be to do the job that we set out to do. And that was just phenomenal. Work with a British boss, a lot of British. I know you have your colleague there, Benjamin. So when I was doing my commute to DC and back, I was listening to your podcast, and it brought a lot of great memories with the people I work with, just because of that accent, and just the folks that I work with were phenomenal. And they work with a lot of German counterparts, and those guys were amazing. Again, it was a coalition. So working in a multicultural environment, understanding what drove our partners and the value system that we were all united into a common goal, that was just really, oh my God, this is powerful. So you can, if you can bring that mindset, that clarity of perspective and driving or attitude, oh my God, you can just do phenomenal things. But again, it comes down to people. It doesn't come down to gadgets. Gadgets are enablers and, you know, and all that. But it's about how you apply that within the human,
you know, landscape. You mentioned clarity of purpose a couple of times, and I believe that that's paramount to success. And, you know, here it is, August of 2020. So we're in the middle, hopefully the middle, maybe on the backside of this COVID pandemic. But I have to share with you, Manny, that I've probably talked to no less than 40 former directors of CI or OpEx programs over the last 4 months. And speaking with them, they did not have a clarity of purpose for the value of their program. To T, every single one of them. One stands out in particular, and he was recently cut loose from transitioned out, you know, whatever the euphemism is. But he was on the outside looking in of his company, and I asked him what the growth strategy. You know, he was talking about how he was very happy and proud of cutting the costs and maintaining the quality and et cetera. And building, the teams. But I asked them, if everything's going well, why were you terminated, right? I mean, if everything's going well and you're producing, why would a person be terminated? So I asked about the company's vision for growth. What was this company, how was it going to grow? How was it going to evolve? How was it going to get to the next level? And he shared with me that their company strategy was to grow by acquisition. Okay, so acquire companies, integrate them into the larger company. So I asked them how many projects were dedicated to the acquisition and integration of these acquired companies. And he said none. All right. So that told me everything I needed to know. The program was not working on what was important. So he ended up being a nice to have, not a need to have.
Right.
And I think that, this clarity of purpose, I think that it is undervalued in business, and especially when it comes to operations. What do we prioritize? What do we prioritize our efforts on? You need to know that. And it's not enough to say we're going to be the number one such and such. Mm-hmm. It's got to be in absolute terms. It's got to be crystal clear so everybody, including the janitor and the new hires, know what absolutely. That is. And
absolutely. I think there's a book I read a few years ago. Of course, I had to quote Jack Welch when he wrote that book, Winning, and how he came up in the idea about, hey, this is what we're going to do. We're going to be the top whatever in this field, whatever, anything else. Then, that's how we align. And we say, if it's not addressing that goal, then you need to take a backseat. That's one example. But nowadays, we're talking about, reducing waste and trying to make our business more efficient because everybody's going through this trauma of looking internally. Hey, what works, what doesn't work? Because we have an existential threat to make sure that we survive this pandemic and come winning on the other side. So everybody wants to get there and win. So I think now is the positioning phase, how you start positioning yourself in a way that, because this is going to pass. Yeah, depends. I mean, many iterations will pass. I mean, we'll go through and all that, but eventually it's going to pass. So how are we going to come, either continue to exist on the other end or come back stronger? So, or redefine ourselves in a way that now we can really have that clarity of purpose, right? Because we can liberate ourselves with things that just burden ourselves with, and now be, not being agile or nimble, over time, bureaucracy crept in and good ideas crept in, and all of a sudden we got this big rucksack, like we call it in the army, all these rocks that are not really helping me get to the end point any faster. So right now I think positioning is definitely having clarity of mind to get you into the right positioning space. So on the other end, you can maximize your talent, like you mentioned, you can either have it in-house, develop it, or bring it and grow it, you know. But how we do that, having that clarity of mind, clarity of purpose, right? They call it know your why, you know. This is basically the thing that we gotta, this is us. And if there's anybody else around that need to know what we do, it needs to be because of this. We are this, you know, and everybody has to embrace that. It has to be in that cultural, that organizational DNA. So back to positioning, I think that's the other quote I read about. I think Geske, he was at a Stanley Cup, like hockey player that, player, but he used to say, I guess he's credited for saying, you got to go where the puck goes, you know, I guess not just chase the puck, you got to go where it's going to go. So now is the time where you can position yourself and be where that puck is going to be once we're over this pandemic. And again, I'm just preaching to the choir, of course. But you know, I mean, there are decisions to be made, but not necessarily getting laying people off is the probably the best strategy. You're letting a lot of institutional knowledge go at the same time. So in the short term, it can help your organization. And I get it; the house is on fire. You got to make sure you put out the fire so you can live for another day. I get it. But I mean, do we want those people to come back to us? I mean, if you have to dismiss folks, the way, you know, perhaps they're going to come back later, but how you treat them on the way out, maybe their consideration to come back and bring value to you later on.
You know, I find that oftentimes these transformational moments, and I'm one of these people, I don't believe that companies transform themselves. They are always transformed by some external threat. Whether it's a pandemic, whether it's 9/11, whether it's a global economic meltdown, these events occur. And I also believe that sometimes these events give the motivation for companies to actually do the right thing. Finally. Yep. Okay. You know, under cover of the disruption. Okay. Mm-hmm. So you think about, you know, General Motors. It was a sick company since 1960s. Everybody saw this slow motion train wreck coming down the track, and it took a global economic meltdown to give GM the opportunity to purge itself of all the sins that it accumulated and didn't unload over the previous 40 or 50 years. Yeah. You know, mm-hmm. And so, you know, there's a lot of trauma in that transition, but the transition was inevitable. It was just waiting for the catalyst. So, you know, sometimes when these opportunities to purge occur, what it actually does is it allows you to concentrate on your core capabilities. Mm-hmm. You know, we get all these different, in diverse interests, and you know, each one of these things takes energy to maintain, right?
Yep.
But sometimes they become unwieldy. You know, you were talking about the forces that you're working with in the Middle East. You know, they're small, they're agile, not like, you know, Desert Storm with a bunch of apparatus. Okay, they're much more nimble, but they still pack a heck of a punch, right?
Absolutely.
You know, so I think that's, you know, bigger isn't always better. Better is
absolutely
better.
You know? Absolutely, and you know. Going back to that human terrain piece, you know, how do you know that when you have to let people go? I don't want to, you know, spend too much time on that because, I mean, there are other more positive perspectives to this.
Yeah, absolutely. But,
you
absolutely. Know,
companies should also think, okay, do you have the people doing the jobs they're supposed to do? You know, are they doing are their skill set really being placed in places that they're valuable absolutely. To the company? And that's what happens a lot, including in my organization. You got folks, okay, you know, you got all these degrees, but now we need somebody to, I don't know, make slides. And you have guys with PhDs in whatever, and because that's what the organization needed you to do at the time. And unfortunately, over time, then you become part of that. Okay, you're known as the slide guy because you're the best slide guy that can do this. And all of a sudden, you have a guy with this capacity, yet being used for that 10% of that capacity because of his visualization skill set, not because of his, you know, geophysicist, you know, working with you, you know. But again, I mean, sometimes we tend to move at warp speed and we want innovation to happen on a schedule or to happen immediately. because we want to sell. We want to sell that vision of where the company is going to go, and we want investors to invest in there. Right. So, you know, this is very similar to, I mean, I'm going to jump into this topic on this new organization, the Army is investing, Army Futures Command. Phenomenal. I mean, we're bringing talent left and right. Everybody's enthusiastic. It's going to take a while. It's going to take some time for the organization. And we're talking about, you know, we call it four-star, basically our CEO, our commander, there's no other rank above him. He reports to the chief of the Army, and then the chief reports to the president. I mean, this is, or the joint chief and then the president. But, you know, this is how big of an organization this is. And it's charged to modernize the Army. Talk about clarity of purpose right there. You know, okay, we're going to modernize the Army. Got it. Check. You know, it hasn't been done in 40 years. Okay, got it. No problem. And within, I think I was in, I was, my boss when I was working in DC was the one that was tagged to do, hey, start designing this thing. And by the way, in a few months, we want to see the concept. And in 6 months later, we're going to unveil it. and then off you go. You know, I like, you know, okay, let's do this, you know, the Army way. We're going to do this one way or the other. I mean, enthusiasm is not, there's no lack of enthusiasm. I mean, but we go.
Well, the great
roll.
Thing is that you get to break things too. Okay. Yeah. There's enthusiasm and you get to break things. All right. Yeah. So that's the great thing about being, I mean, you know, assigned to innovation. Well, the expectation is there's going to be a lot of failure.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, that's the expectation. You know, when we're innovating, we're going into things that we don't know about. Okay. Or we're pushing the edges. We're inventing new edges and we're going beyond those edges. And so there's going to be a lot of things that we just break. And you know, that it's great to break them in a lab rather than out in the field, right?
And break we will do. And we do that very well. In fact, as we speak this month and next month, our first demonstration of the technologies that is being put through the research and development process are going to be demonstrated in Arizona. And again, COVID or not, we're going to do this. I'm like, oh, my God. Yeah. So it's going to happen. The Army way, we're going to figure out. But we got to – I mean, and this was a heck of an experience, man, because, you know, within the Army, being part of that initial design of the organization, I mean, many ideas came through. A lot of folks with a lot of big thinking brains have been looking into this structure. And it's a big investment for the Army because, I mean, again, we know we're not gonna modernize overnight, but it's about getting the journey going. So we embrace a lot of these minimum viable product concepts. Hey, yeah, do things, you know, make sure that you do things frequently. But then we have to be cautious about this failing thing because you want to fail smart too, but you want to have your wins along the way. You don't want to be known because you're the guy that fails often. It's like, all right, you know, I don't know if I want to invest in a company that fails all the time, you know.
Yeah, we have to, you know, they say you fail fast, fail small, learn and move on. And I made the comment a couple of days ago in another similar conversation. It's like, you know what? You have to succeed sometimes. Okay, it's not enough about just failing all the time. You actually have to put some points on the board. You know what I mean? And you know, so that's pretty fun.
Well, I mean, and communicate that. And that's the other thing. Sometimes, and again, we go back into the cultural dilemma where, you know, and this is, and I sidetrack a little bit. When you have in our Army, we're go-getters. This is the mission. We're gonna do it. And then you bring the scientific community. You bring folks from government, the civil service folks that are also very that's career folks that dedicate their professional life to working the acquisition, science and technology. How you work on budgets. How you enable these things to work. You know, and we're all coming together. And now you have the military guys say, hey, we're gonna do this in a deliberate way. Then you have the innovators that are on the other opposite side of the spectrum where they we want to go out there where people have never gone before. Yeah. You know, so you have it's like a continuum where you have they call it the adapters, the guys that are very highly creative, but very methodically about their learning, very sequential. You know, and then you have the other side of the spectrum, which are the innovators, the Michelangelos, the people that want to go out in space and do great things. But again, it's hard to manage these two opposite yet valuable perspective on innovation. So you got to bring it into the middle. There's a concept that I study in Penn State that is called the Curtin's Adaptation Innovation Theory. And I highly recommend you look into that. It's phenomenal because it's about how you enable creativity and innovation in teams and how these human characteristics come into that teaming performance where you have your high innovators and your highly adapters come in play. And they all have a place. When you want to work in, when you are working in R&D, you want to have those innovators in there because they want to go into places right. that nobody has gone before. But eventually, you got to bring that innovation into a way that can have some schedules, some deliverables along the way, some quick wins along the way. You know, and that's when you have to bring your adapters in play and keep that balance in your team. So as a team, as a technical team leader, what is your place there? Because if you start building your team on only adapters, hey, good luck, man, because, you know, they're hard to control. You know, these innovators, I mean, they don't want to go over time schedules. I just give them money and they'll go out and go from shiny object to shiny object, you know, and then you bring that. So, the two personalities here, problem-solving personalities are the innovators with the type of Michelangelos, and on the left side of the continuum are your Thomas Edisons, you know, the guys that are going to bring the, you know, build the, break the light bulb, you know, 3,000 times until you get the right mix in there. But that's what we see here in organizations like this, in highly innovating organizations. And back to Army Futures Command, this is the mosaic of personalities that we're working in, but again, you know, how you innovate the Army and our boss, our CEO, our commander, 4-star General Murray, he mentioned, hey guys, just give me your 60% solution and I'm fine with it. And this is a 4-star CEO telling me, I'm fine with a 60% solution and continue to iterate. But then you go into the culture of, hey, I'm a type A Army guy or type A scientist. I'm not going to give you a 60% solution. I want to give you the 110% solution, which takes longer, takes more time, more resources.
And by the time that you get that 110% solution, the problem has changed.
Yes, the time factor.
Okay. Yeah,
absolutely.
The problem has changed. So listen, we're getting towards the end of the show here, and I know that you have some pet project that you're working on. Would you like to share that with the audience?
Absolutely. So hopefully what I'm transmitting to you and to the audience is that folks in the military, you know, we do many jobs, you know, because we are on a most likely a 20-year career path, and we, to progress, you take more responsibility, you learn new skills, that you adapt to new environments, you know, and you work in teams. Nobody's working alone. And in fact, it goes against our DNA, our culture. You don't stand by your own, you know, you work with your teammates to get what you set out to do.
Right.
So a lot of these folks are getting out of the Army, are retiring, are moving on to other jobs for many reasons, either completed their 20-year tenure or more, or they just completed their you know, their assignment with the Army and they're moving on to other things. And these are folks that are joining our ranks, you know, and this is talent. This is talent that is out there. These people are hungry. They're hungry to get the job, to get the mission done. They're not looking for Rolex gold watches. They're looking for purpose. They're looking for clarity of mission and be part of a team. So, you know, there's an organization that I want to bring about, and this is what I did. A colleague of mine, his name is Michael Quinn. He is the CEO of Higher Military. He's a nonprofit, and it's under...
What's the name of it again? Sorry?
Higher Military.
Higher Military. Higher Military.
Yep. Higher Military, yeah. Pardon my Canadian accent here, but yeah. So I put it here for people to... It's on LinkedIn. What this organization does, what Mike does, he helps organizations use a program that the Army... I mean, this is phenomenal. It's a win-win, hands down. It's called the DOD, the Department of Defense Skill Bridge Program. And what it is, it provides companies basically the ability to bring soldiers, you know, military personnel into their business to work with them for free. It's a training with industry program. And these folks are already in the military. They're already, their salaries are already being covered and benefits. Basically, their place of duty is with the organization. And this happens 6 months before they retire or they get out of the Army.
So let me just paraphrase, just so I understand. So this organization takes Army personnel that are getting prepared to transition out, and they place them almost like an internship within an organization that they're paid for by the company, by the government, by the U.S. Army still.
All right.
But they're embeds in a company, and they the personnel transitioning out learn from the company. The company learns from the personnel. Is it a symbiotic learning experience?
Absolutely. And basically, the military service person tries out the company. The company tries them out. They actually are working for the company. And then if the company say, you know, you're a good fit, they can decide to hire that person. But again, it's a no risk to the company, because this person is already part of the, it's still in the military. It's just a place of duty will be with the company.
Right.
It's phenomenal. A lot of folks are, the hiring rate is about 92%.
Well, I would imagine folks, so.
Oh yeah. I mean, they're already a trusted agent within the company. They reduced the risk of hiring someone. They're already being, you know, they're already being going native with the company. And basically, you know, most likely there's a good way to find what will be the good place, the right skill set that adds value to the purpose of that company.
And so let me ask another question. The ranks, this is all Army personnel. First off, two questions. Is it restricted just to the Army, or is this service-wide?
Service-wide.
Okay, so service-wide. Okay, Department of Defense. And it's not just officers. It's officers, enlisted, et cetera.
In fact, Mike Quinn, he was a retired sergeant major. He right now works as a consultant and also the CEO for this nonprofit. And, this is agnostic of rank. In fact, I don't want to even dwell on rank, because that creates certain bias that is unfounded. These folks are leaders, no matter what the rank. These are folks that are, again, already proven, vetted by the Department of Defense, cleared, meaning they have the government trusts them with our most kept secrets. So these are, you know, they're already being, again, they're still in the Army, and they're working for you. So it reduces an immense amount of risk for any company that is willing to
absolutely. And the only reason I was asking that question is because you're going to have people that are experienced welders. You're going to have people that are experienced aircraft repair people, heavy equipment operators, et cetera, et cetera. So you're going to have all of these different skill sets, with that they've applied hands on, for the military for however many years they might've been in the military.
Absolutely. So for any employer, colleague of yours and that are listening in, Mike Quinn, he can help direct to get this program, because the employer can get in discussions with this organization and help them along the way. Because, again, it helps service members, it helps the employer, and it helps the economy overall. I mean, I don't see any type of risk there. So why not?
So you'll be sure to get me all the information that I need so I could include it on the webpage for the podcast, right? Good.
Absolutely.
It sounds like a wonderful program. Thanks for sharing that, Manuel.
Yes. My pleasure.
Good.
This I can do.
So we're at the speed round. You ready? You ready for
Let's
the speed
it.
Round? Okay, we got
all
three
right.
questions that I'm going to ask you. All right?
One more.
What's the best piece of advice you ever received?
All right. When you go to a new organization, keep your head on your shoulders, eyes and ears open. You know, learn it, observe, see how people communicate. Body language is a key communicator. See what makes them move, you know, what is valuable to them, and then find ways to add value regardless. Titles, resumes, I know that's great, but for one to become a trusted agent, you got to demonstrate that you can help push that noodle up the hill, that you can add value to whatever that enterprise you set out to do.
Okay, thanks. So the second question is, who is one of your heroes and why?
All right, my hero is actually my wife. you know, I have to bring her in. Back to the story about.
I would agree
know,
with that, by the way. From everything that you've said, I would absolutely. Unreservedly agree with that statement.
Oh, I'm glad you are on board, buddy.
Yeah. But she's almost my hero now.
Well, she's super. I mean, she is my hero. I mean, because of her, I've been able to do the things that I set out to do. She keeps my head on my shoulders and my ears open. You know, she actually makes me see things that sometimes I don't see because of my enthusiasm and my winning personality. But no, joking aside, she is my hero. I mean, the things that she has been going through to support me is just, I mean, talk about an example of grit and determination. And that's something that, you know, how you teach that. And, right. And my challenge and our challenge, and I don't think it's her challenge, is like, I want to pass that on to my kids. And, you know, teach grit,
right.
Teach resiliency. And she demonstrates all that. She doesn't have to teach it because she demonstrates that. So anyways, that's my answer to you. I mean, I can go on.
That's
and
a
on
great
and
answer.
On,
but, you know. That's a great answer. And I can completely understand that answer from the story you shared earlier. So the last question is, if you had one do-over, what would it be?
All right. You ready for this?
I'm ready.
All right. If I have one do-over and people are going about to like, probably if you're in traffic, you're about to like go on the side. I should have gone with my wife. I should have gone out sooner with her. It took me a year by the time I met her to the time I went out with her. You know, I didn't want to make a bad impression. So I decided, hey, I'm here in Panama. You know, I want to, you know, get to know the culture. I was going native, but it took me a year to, go, you know, I was like, I wasted a year. What was I thinking? What a knucklehead. Anyways, I should have gone.
But on the other hand, it worked out just fine, right?
But okay? It worked out.
Because, you know, just think, if you had accelerated that, yeah. You might have screwed it up.
Yeah, that's right. I didn't even give her a chance. Okay. I didn't give her a chance.
So, you know, if we look at the outcomes, okay, not the inputs, but the outputs. If we look at the outcomes, I think there would be great peril and possibly doom if you had tried to accelerate it.
I think so. And and she makes sure she reminds me of it. And now that I'm kind of looking into my next chapter and all that, she's like, okay, you're all mine now.
Awesome.
You're all mine now. And how can I say no to that? It's her turn.
Awesome. Awesome.
All right.
So I guess that brings us to the conclusion, Manny. I want to thank you for your time and giving the audience, which is what, in my opinion, one of the best episodes that we've recorded. Great stories, good laughs, a lot of quality content. Thank you for sharing everything that you shared with me and eventually the audience. So thank you very much for
thank you, JP. I mean, I'm so fortunate to, you know, a few months ago we had that virtual beer, you know, and I wrote about it. It's like, hey, man, this is something that has been in the making for about 4 years. I was listening to you and Benjamin, on the podcast, and again, I was doing a four hour commute every day between where I live and DC. And let me tell you, you brought some laugh. I'm like, man, this is a good podcast. I, there's no way I can speak like these people do. I mean, they tell the stories and so refined and so well spoken. But like,
dude,
hey,
you just did it. Okay, you just did it. So maybe this there's awesome. A podcast in your future.
I gotta ask my wife.
So thanks again, Manny, for joining. So,
thank you, JP. This has been phenomenal.
My pleasure. So you've been listening to State of Readiness, a fireside chat with Joseph Paris and Manny Ugarte today. Thank you very much for joining us. See you next time. Bye.
Thank you for listening to State of Readiness. You can discover more episodes and learn about the book written by Joseph Paris of the same title at www.state-of-readiness.com. You can learn more about Joseph Paris at www.josephparis.me/card.